All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We're going to get started. Yesterday, the calls were really light. I'm not sure why. Today, they're starting to roll in pretty quickly. But if you jump in right now with a question, a comment, a topic, you've still got a really good chance. In fact, if you press one on your phone right now, I guarantee I'll get to you. But if you wait a little bit longer, we might not. We're going to try to do 2 hours today. We'll just see how the questions go. So let's get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call, and we'll talk about it here on the air. We're going to get to those calls in just a little bit. Reading through the news this morning, I see that the last holdout, Peterbilt, has opted out of the Mid-America Truck Show in Louisville for 2016. That means there will be no truck manufacturers there at all. Everybody else already announced they're pulling out. Kenworth, Volvo, Mack, International, Freightliner, they're already gone, and Peterbilt just announced that they won't be going either. What it looks like the truck manufacturers are planning on doing is attending the Mid-America Truck Show every other year. And part of the reason, obviously, is cost. It is outrageously expensive for those manufacturers to be there. I remember in, I think it was 08 or 09 when the economy tanked and they all pulled out. I remember reading some numbers that they were forfeiting like $700,000 that they already paid to be in the show, but that they were going to save $1 million more by not going. So it looks like they'll save quite a bit by going every other year. But one of their bigger reasons wasn't necessarily the cost. It was the fact that they don't have anything really new to show every year. Their build cycles and their production cycle, they just don't create new stuff every year. So it looks like they're going to an every other year at Matt's. Now, if you've ever been to Matt's and you see the kind of displays that the major truck manufacturers do, if they're gone, it literally wipes out that the main hall there. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. We are rethinking our truck show strategy. We want to be at truck shows, but we want to be able to bring more value. More value than just somebody walking by, looking at something and talking. We're not sure what that means yet. You know, I love doing seminars at truck shows, but it is such a fight. You know, and Mid-America's is just changed so much over the years. You know, it's one family that runs and owns that show, and they've done an amazing job with the show. But I haven't been very happy with their decisions about seminars and education. The first seminar I was ever a part of was at the Mid-America Trucking Show back in 1997, and we packed a room of about 500 people, standing room only, and we had a great seminar. I've done some seminars at Louisville back in the early 2000s where I went. You know, we were scheduled for 3 hours. One time I stayed for six. You know, nobody threw us out of the room. The show was over. I was still in there answering questions. I had a ball that day. And we've always wanted to do more education at the truck shows, but it's always a fight. And it's not even money. I mean, it's just the fact that lately at Louisville, the way they schedule their seminars is they will only give each vendor an hour. But to make it worse, they literally schedule, like my seminar would be scheduled from 12 to 1. There would be a seminar scheduled from 2 to 3 and one from 11 to 12. Which means by the time the seminar that ends at 12 actually ends and you can get them off the stage and out of the room, and then I have to come in and set up my equipment, I've lost at least 15 minutes no matter how prepared I am, which now means I'm down to 45 and then I'm going to be cutting into the next person's seminar because they're going to try to get into the room early. It's a disaster, and I'm not even sure why they do it that way. There's plenty of seminar room. So, you know, over the years, it's just they constantly change. We're always fighting with them. It's just never been a good situation. Like when we do the CMC, we are able to control everything and make the entire experience good. We always know the information is going to be good, but you can lose a lot with that experience of, you know, trying to get equipment set up and mics and getting sound right, and you can't go in and do things. When I normally do seminars, I like to be in the room 3 hours ahead of time. I like to walk through all the technology, make sure everything's working right to create that really good experience, which makes the information even better. So we are looking at some ways that we could possibly change our truck show strategy to bring more value. Now, it's not a big deal to me that the truck manufacturers aren't there because I don't care about new trucks anyway. I know a lot of people want to go see those trucks, but this may work to our advantage. And when I read this morning, realized they all pulled out, I thought, what could we come up with show strategy that we could go negotiate with Mid-America and create some real value, maybe use some of that space? I'm not sure what that means or what that looks like yet, but it's something we are going to continue working on. All right. I had a couple other things, but you know what? I'm going to get right to some phone calls. Let's start off in Dallas. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, hang on.
Okay. I'll do a little song and dance and entertain everybody while we're waiting.
Okay, there you go. Oh, so anyway, hi, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've been reading some of your favorite literature, the IRS website.
Oh, boy.
And I'm confused. I don't know if I'm just not thinking about this correctly and I need to think about it another way. But here's what I'm confused over is that I want to start an individual 401k for Seth and I. And according to what I've read, you can do that as a partnership, which is what status that we are right now. What okay. I'm confused about is when I was a company driver, any money that I put into my 401k, I didn't have to pay taxes on. So
right.
What I'm confused about is when we get the settlement, we put back tax money and we put back retirement money. So what I'm confused about, though, is I don't know how much of my taxes I'm going to have be able to defer. I know that there are limits, and I'm over 50, so between Seth and I, we can put back probably more money than we can put back.
right.
So I'm just confused about what do I get to defer away from taxes, and what do
okay.
I still have to, how do I figure out what I owe them and what I get to defer? That's what I don't understand.
Got it. So I'll try to do this simply, even though there is really no simple answer to this. And let me just start to explain why. As a partnership, you could open an IRA, you could open a Roth IRA, You could open an individual 401k. You could open an individual Roth 401k. You could open a SEP. You could open a simple. All of those are different types of retirement accounts, but the only reason they're different, it has nothing to do with the investments or the account or anything. All of those different accounts exist only because of the difference in the IRS rules. That's the only reason. If we didn't have all these IRS rules and if we had a fair tax, you would just have an investment account and we'd be done with it. But every one of those accounts has a different rule or a different set of rules about how much you can contribute, who can contribute, what's deductible, when is it deductible. It goes on and on. But we can simplify this. The first thing I always want you to remember is no matter what form of business you are or what type of account you open, you will never save anything in employment taxes like Social Security and Medicare, or what we call self-employment tax. You will never save any of that. So that's the first rule to remember. When I come back, I'll tell you what you can contribute and how to know what to deduct, sort of. I'll explain when we get back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I was talking with Rebecca about retirement accounts. So, Rebecca, I'm going to cut to the chase and make this easy, and as easy as I can. And I'm going to direct you to the type of account that, based on our rules today, which could always change, but based on the rules today, will give you the most flexibility as far as how you contribute, how much you contribute, and when you get to deduct. So I'm going to tell you the account first, and then we can talk about how to use it. So what you want to open is an individual Roth 401k.
Now, the
good news is, even though it's called a Roth 401k, you don't have to treat the contributions like a Roth, but you can. You get to pick and choose. Yeah, and you can even mix and match in the same year. And as a partnership, you would be able to contribute sometimes as much as $40,000 a year. So it just blows away the contributions of, say, a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA. Now, you may not need that much. You may not ever need that much, but why not open the account that gives you the most flexibility over time? That's why I recommend this one. Even if somebody comes to me and says, look, I know I need to do this, but I can only afford $1,000 this year. So what? Maybe next year you'll be able to afford 10, who knows? Or maybe 10 years from now. So why not start with this account? Now, as far as what you can deduct off your taxes everything you put into this account as a traditional contribution. If you decide that you want the money to go in as a Roth contribution, then it's not going to affect your taxes at all. Not right now.
The
Roth will affect your taxes when you retire. The traditional will affect your taxes now. My recommendation has always been to think very, very hard about putting as much money into it as a Roth as possible, even though you don't get the tax benefit now. Because the tax benefit at the end is much bigger. than what you get now. So that's always the decision. But it, let's say you decide, okay, this year we can afford to put $5,000 in total, and we're going to split it even. We're going to do $2,500 as a Roth and $2,500 as a traditional. What you would be able to deduct then would be $2,500 off of your income tax as income, which means that if you're roughly in the 15% tax bracket, you're only saving, $375. You're saving $375 in tax.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, we've already got a traditional Roth, and both of us do, and we rolled over our 401ks, and so now it's just a matter of, you know, how did we want to structure it now that we were self-employed. And I read the article, and I was getting the part where they were showing the guy, you know, figuring out his self-employment tax. And I thought, okay, so you figure out your self-employment tax, and then the other part you defer, and I was confused. But the numbers that you gave really helped me there, so that'll help me figure out, you know, which way to go and what to do with that. I heard the other day your suggestion on the book for money, and I'll go ahead and download that. I'm not on Facebook, so I don't get your other recommendations until you just say them on the air. So, anyway,
that book, I would recommend you get that book, and honestly, I would recommend you get it in audio and paperback.
And paper, with my favorites.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's one of those books that has so much specific information about what to do. Go to this website. Go open this type of an account with this brokerage firm, and here's why. That it's wonderful to listen to while you're driving, but when it's time to work the plan, you want to be able to go back to the book and highlight things and flag pages. And
So I
would really recommend getting both. But I can say I went through 3 years of schooling for financial planning. I sat for the CFP exam, passed it the first time, practiced for a couple years, did a lot of continuing education. And honestly, if I just would have listened to this book and learned everything in this book, I would have been better off.
It's funny.
Yeah,
hey, listen,
good, though.
I wanted to ask you a question. We got the break safe, which is really cool. I like that. But my question is that the weather's changed since we put it on, and all of our markers are in between the goalposts, but some of them seem farther back in the bracket than they used to be. Is that because of the weather? I mean, I know that when your slack adjusters go. So I don't know if
and I'll try to explain it. As long as you're within the goalpost, we know we're good. And, you know, being within the goalpost gives us a lot of room. I mean, it's not like one day you're going to be within the goalpost and the next day you're going to be out. You know, brakes wear over time, and we have a pretty wide range where we're legal and safe. But what can happen with weather changes, it's just like one of my cars has a tire pressure monitoring system, and it's so sensitive that I keep getting warnings right now, and I have to go in and reset it because the cold temperatures have reduced the pressure by just a couple pounds, but it's enough to keep setting off the warnings. The same thing happens on all that metal. As all the metal contracts, you're going to see a different reading. It's the opposite of what happens when our brakes get really hot going down a big hill, and why you lose braking power, because as you get that drum hot, it expands away from the brakes.
Just the
contraction in the metal from the colder temperature.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought. I've always been a 100% person, and I get nervous when things aren't 100%.
Yeah.
So anyway, Okay, well, that's good to know. I'll tell you really quickly. We're doing an experiment here to see. I don't know if this is going to work or not, but we were getting these crazy oil samples, and we were getting fuel dilution with our viscosity going up. And we're like, what the heck? So the guy from OPS said, have you thought about a fuel pump? And I thought, I thought, because we're also getting like nearly 8 miles to the gallon. And so I'm like, that's not an injector. And so anyway, we went ahead. We were going to get the FAST system anyway. We were going to get it a little later on, but we went ahead and put it on, and we haven't pulled the fuel sample yet, but I'll let you know what happens. We're going to see if maybe the fuel pump was just getting a little bit worn out, and that's what the problem was. The guy at OPS suggested that we do that, so we did. So,
excellent.
Anyway,
sounds good.
I also want to tell you I'm really enjoying Destination Health. I was glad that you put it on the air the other night because I don't always get to listen, you know, when you do it or go back and get the podcast. And this stuff about prostate cancer is so important that people understand that, you know, that most men do get prostate cancer and they die with it as opposed to from it. And you've got Major League Baseball out there going, oh, you got to go get this test, and, you know.
Yeah. there's a lot of money in promoting the test. Lots and lots and lots of money. I can't even stress that enough because we're surrounded with these messages and they come at us from so many different places, we think it must be true. But it's not.
Yeah.
Just follow the money. There's a lot of money in telling people to do this, not only in giving the test, but in the biopsy that they're going to recommend afterwards, in the surgery they might recommend after that. It's all about the money. But there's no money in the opposite message.
Exactly.
There's no money in trying to explain to people what the downsides are. And it's not just a matter of, you know, you don't have to get this done. That's not the only downside. The downside is getting it done can have some very, very negative consequences.
Well, I was really happy that you're helping to get the word out on that. It's so hard these days, to understand your own health. I told my naturopath, I said, you know, sometimes I feel like I need to go get a medical degree just so I can be a good consumer.
it really does feel like that. And I'll tell you the other thing that I don't know if it really should surprise me or not, but I've had some lightly veiled death threats because of some of the advice I've given. That's how emotional people get about this. And all I'm trying to do is get the other side of the story out there. We are so surrounded by these health messages that are mostly just about money. They're not about anybody's health. They're about money. The other side of the story doesn't pay to get it out, and I get death threats over it. Oh, well, that's what we do here, though. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to head off to Florida. Lori, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can I help you with today?
Okay, I have a question. You know, Adam calls you obsessively about expanding, expanding, expanding. And I'm over here on the other end, behind the scenes, doing the money, saying no, no, no. And I'm starting to get real confused because I know that I listen to your show plenty of times, say that people who get a bunch of trucks in a real short period of time end up failing and losing it, and I don't want that to happen. Now, my question for you is, we don't have money sitting in the bank, thousands and thousands of dollars, ready to go buy more trucks and get more trailers. And I know we don't need to with Penske, as you know, to buy a truck or buy a trailer or what have you. But
right.
My question is don't you think a company should have some sort of foundation built first before they want to go get another 3-4 more trucks to add on and expand so quickly? Or is it just because I feel overwhelmed with all the, you know, all the accounting stuff that I'm doing now? There's another run, there's another bank account, there's another employee, there's another tax, there's another this.
Right.
What is your intake on this whole?
I've got a one-word answer for you that you're just going to love.
Okay.
Maybe.
Just do it? You just want me to do it?
No, not really. And let me explain why. Business is never quite black and white. You know, there are times when I will do one thing or even give one answer. It really happens a lot being on the air and answering a lot of different questions. There are times when I'll give one person one answer. A week later, somebody will hear what they think is the same question, and I'll give somebody a totally different answer. And that can be very confusing. But I, being in business a long time, in a lot of different businesses, being around trucking as long as I have, I look at all the nuances. And I'm pretty sure I even talked with Adam about this on the air. Had he wanted to go out and buy a California-compliant truck in order to take on this contract, I said, absolutely not. There's too much risk in those trucks. One bad California could wipe out your whole operation. It's not worth the risk. Now, if these weren't California-compliant, we could go out and buy $10,000 trucks and you had cash sitting in the bank, that would have been a slam dunk.
Okay.
Then, so you're right. I've answered that question the exact opposite many, many times before. Now, there's another question he's asked me about renting trucks from Penske.
Yep.
And I bet in the last 5 years, I bet I've told 25 people, stupid idea. Don't even think about going to Penske to rent a truck. They're going to eat up all your profit.
Yep.
And it doesn't make any sense because you're in the business of owning trucks. And yet you're going to give that profit of owning the truck to somebody else. So on the surface, I can see why he asked two questions. And normally I say no to both of them. In his case, I said yes. And I'll explain the reason why. Because most people who ask me about buying a California-compliant truck are just going to go out and pull general freight with it. Well, that's a bad idea. There's too much risk. Most people who are going to go rent a truck from Penske, they're just going to go pull general freight. They have no idea how much money they're going to make, and they're going to give up too much profit. But when we put both of those factors together and we look at a contract where kind of already know how it works, we know what the numbers are. There's clear profit available. I mean, we can just do the math. It pays this much a mile, where it's going to cost us this much to own the truck, and we have no risk around maintenance. That maintenance is not an issue. It's not an unknown because that's part of the lease. They cover all that. They're taking the risk on maintenance. Our only real risk is fuel economy, because we can't really do much to that truck to get fuel economy. But we can even live with that. I took the worst case scenario and said, what if this truck that you rent gets 5.5 miles to the gallon and there's nothing you can do about it? That's worst case. We ran the numbers. There was still profit available. And
I'm feeling that too on the fuel end. It's kind of hurting me a little bit on my Florida run because Fleet One takes it out of my Florida account, not the California account, because I can't separate the invoices. So I'm feeling it more in one account than I am in the other. So, but I'm doing it. We're making it happen.
Yeah, and one of the things you're learning there, see, you get this, and you have the numbers, and I love this, because you're learning those nuances. You know, mm-hmm. you're learning how those things affect the operation in different ways. So mm-hmm. my philosophy in business is we try to maximize profit and minimize risk. Looking at these numbers, there's a chance under this contract, a pretty high chance of adding profit to the bottom line of the company. When we run the numbers, yeah, you put this truck on, you get this much a mile, you pay this much out to Penske, you pay for the driver, you pay for fuel, and there's money left over. So we're going to make some profit. Now, where's the risk? Honestly, there really isn't.
No.
Because if it doesn't work, you just turn the truck back in.
Correct. And there's another opportunity out there I'm sure he's already talked to you about, where now he wants, by the beginning of the year, is to add three more trucks on. It would be doubling the number that we're making on this California run and not even having to buy trailers, pulling company trailers. And I'm scared to death.
Now, you should
one
be.
One truck at a time, of course. Yeah, he's yelling at me. One truck at a time. But still, I'm scared to death.
Yeah, and you should be. And let me tell you why that's a good thing. I don't know whether – let me first tell you the downside. Even after everything I said about very little risk, the one downside, the one risk you could run is that if you overwhelm the two of you, that the whole business could fall apart. There isn't much risk in each individual truck. But if we're not careful and we add too many too fast and you overwhelm the whole system, we could fail just under the weight of the whole system. So that's the one thing I would caution you about. The other thing I will tell you is you being afraid is a very good thing. You being afraid is a very good thing. It's a good balance. I'm a lot like Adam. I'm a natural risk taker. I always think I can make everything work. I don't care how many things you tell me are going to go wrong, I'll solve the problem. And Adam is just like that. That's a good thing. That's what entrepreneurs do. It's also good to have that balance that says, hey, slow down. Let's think about it. Let's take our time a little bit. Where the problem can come in is when those two people are also married. Because
that's where we're at right
very,
now.
And I wish I had a good answer for you for that part of the equation, but if I did, I'd probably be Dr. Phil.
That's true. That is true.
So,
well, and that's because Adam and I had a plan together was, okay, we have Florida, get a house. Oh, no, the California run. Okay, let's put the house on hold. Now we did the California, and then it's supposed to be the house. Now Adam comes back and says, oh, no. We have to go do this other one, and it's going to be in another three, four more months. And I'm like, now wait, you promised house for Lori. I've been working hard. I've been doing everything. I've been paying the bills. I'm getting all our debt paid off. I paid off my car payment yesterday. No more car payment. We're excelling. We're raising six other people in the house. We have, we're doing the best that we can. And Adam... That's where Adam and I are right now, where I'm like, well, what about the house? Well, can we take a break? Because I'm ready to call Marcus at, Clifton Larson and be like, all right, you got to take over all this paperwork because it's so hard, Kevin, to keep track of our money. It goes out and comes in.
That may be a good thing to do. I mean, I don't know, but, it is something to consider. I'm going to throw in... And you may not like this, but I'm going to throw in what could be the tiebreaker. Because both arguments make a lot of sense. There's no question. Probably the reason I come from this point of view is because this is what I've always done. I am the risk taker. I do look for the opportunities.
Right.
But and I understand the house and all that stuff. I've been through it, too. I've put personal things on hold. And here's my usual rationale for doing that is that when there is a clear, unique business opportunity, and I don't mean just putting on a truck and putting a driver in it. That's not a clear, unique opportunity. That has existed every day since I've been in the business. But when there's a specific opportunity, like these contracts he's looking at, that may not come along later. And 3 months from now, there will still be houses on the market.
That's right.
So I'm going to get to a break. And like I say, that was the that might be the tiebreaker. I know that doesn't fall on the side that you want it to fall on. But think about that for a minute, and we'll come right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Quick heads up, we're heading into the fourth segment of the first hour. We're going to come back and do another hour. We have lots of questions on hold right now, so I'll keep you updated, but here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I was talking with Lori in Florida. So, Lori, that's one way we might look at this as a tiebreaker, but I also want to throw something on your side of this, too. Because at some point, no matter how many opportunities are available, we should probably take a step back and reach some of the personal goals as well. Because I will tell you, that I'm always out there looking for new business opportunities. I finally got to the point where I realized there's so many opportunities. The better you get at business, they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would do if I were you, and now I'm heading into Dr. Phil territory here, I'm going to mediate. I would say, based on the numbers Adam gave me, this is a really good opportunity. It's pretty risk-free. Nothing is ever totally risk-free in business, but this has a really good risk-to-reward ratio. But this would also be a good time for you to negotiate an absolute. So, and by an absolute, I say, no matter what the next opportunity is, we have to take some time and work on the personal goals first. So we'll do this.
Okay.
You know, what, 3 trucks or 2 trucks or 5 or whatever it is you two agree on. There's an opportunity there. We are going to go for it. It is going to put our personal goals back 3 months or 6 months. But then, no matter what opportunities are available, we're going to work on the personal goals next, and then we can go back to the business. Because I will tell you that at some point, no matter how successful you are in business, if you don't work some on the personal side, you're just not going to be happy.
Right, right. And what about being, jumping into this new, these new contracts and not having a whole lot of money behind you? It makes me nervous that we're going to put all our eggs in one basket, and I don't play like that. I like having a little cushion, and it's making me real nervous, like,
cash,
especially with
cash
renewal on my insurance,
wonderful.
Killed me this month.
Cash is wonderful. There's no question. I love when I'm in a position that there's lots of cash to back things up.
Yeah.
But I've been on the other side of the fence far more often. Most businesses I start, I start what most people would consider to be underfunded, undercapitalized. I don't know if it's the excitement I like about it or the fact that the opportunity is there and I don't want to wait. That's a pretty typical entrepreneur. And you do have to find some balance. There's no question. There's also the idea of, well, if we stay where we are right now, it's going to take us 6 months to build up $25,000. But if the new contract works out, we could build that up in 3 months instead because we have more money coming in. Again, that's the optimism of the entrepreneur. We'll fix all the problems and there'll be more cash available. There's no easy answer to that one.
No.
It's just something you've got to you know, work through and come mm-hmm. to an agreement on and get comfortable with.
Well, and for me, paying off debt means freeing up money. So when I'm paying off
right.
my car payment, now I have that $350 a month I can apply towards the business or towards groceries or towards something else. And our trailer payment is going to be paid off in July. Well, there's $1,000 that's going to be freed up to reinvest into the company or
right.
to manage our fuel costs or whatever the case may be, because basically there's nothing left to do in the truck that we have. So I don't have Adam saying, well, I need $1 million for the FAST system, or I need $1 million for the OPS system, or I haven't heard that in
right.
months, other than I need $4,000 for tires, or I need, and I'm like, here it is.
Yeah.
You know, now today
yeah.
I can actually say, oh yeah, okay, here you go. There's the money. And really, debt-wise, other than a few little credit cards that we have, we're actually getting to a very comfortable position for me to say, hey, okay, you know, let's go ahead and get that other truck and get the contract with this one. I'm just afraid to go in it when we're still not at my comfort zone. But with Adam, you know, he does know what he's doing. He talks to you, listens to you every day, all the time. So, you know, as long as, I don't know.
Well, and let me, I think you two make an amazing pair. I really do. I think it's a great combination. The you two balance each other really well in business. If you can
uh-huh.
stop from tearing each other's heads off when you disagree, and it can get emotional. And like
yeah.
I said, I've had business partners that have been good balance for me, and
uh-huh.
we fought like cats and dogs most of the time. But the good news is, when it was time to go home, I didn't have to go home with them. You know,
true.
So you could come back the next day and do it again. It's always mm-hmm. more difficult when, you know, you're living with the person and sleeping with the person. But the best advice I can give you is treat business like business, where you two are equals. You know,
mm-hmm.
both of you are contributing to the business. You both have valid opinions, and you just have to hammer those things out. I mean, that's what business is about.
Yep.
The really difficult part is figuring out a way that when you go home at night, you drop all the business stuff, you give each other a hug, and you go have fun. That's
exactly.
the most difficult part. But if you two can both remember that, you know, if
okay.
nothing else,
okay.
if you just keep reminding each other, hey, look, I know we were screaming at each other over this business decision, but that has nothing to do with why we love each other and why we live together.
Right. Okay. Sounds fair enough.
All right, and keep me informed.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Wait, one more thing. Our chiropractor,
sure.
Dr. Pari, I gave Lisa all her information, and she pretty much knows everything about that diet that you guys did. That diet personally did not work for me. It caused me a lot of health problems that may have been under the surface, and then when I shocked my system into eating and taking all my sugar away, it basically threw me into an inflammation state. So I have some things I have to maybe go do like a raw diet for myself. So the diet
yeah.
you guys are doing
yeah.
doesn't work well for me, but Dr. Pari, she's a female. She knows all about the lady stuff, and she's going to be a really, you know, good information, you know, I mean, she's just amazing. So she's going to be able to talk to you guys about things, and then for the women as well, because our bodies really work a lot different because you guys have that testosterone to balance that out, where
yes.
the women will go into that adrenal gland fatigue and mess your hormones
yeah,
all up.
Adrenal fatigue, yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there's
so,
no question. Thyroid and adrenals mm-hmm. and all kinds of things. Your hormonal balance is a whole lot more sensitive than ours. So
mm-hmm.
it's wonderful that you're working with somebody that understands that there isn't one perfect diet for anybody. I mean, even
correct.
If we take men, not
mm-hmm.
every man should be eating the exact same macronutrient balance. It's very individual. And that's part of what I think that most people who follow paleo or ketogenic,
mm-hmm.
many of them understand that the health advice we get from our government, from the Diabetes Association, the Heart Association, one of the biggest problems with all that advice, not only that it's wrong, but that they believe that one set of recommendations fits everybody, and it just doesn't.
Right. That's very true. Yeah, that's very true.
So
So
we are going to talk to her about having her on the air with us. She sounds like a great resource, so thank you for that. Let's head off to Florida. Gene, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How's it going?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I had talked to you. I was on with Kim one day, and I had a question about cholesterol, and you had called in, and I had back in June, I had my annual, and my doctor wanted to increase my statin, and I told him about, you know, what you were doing and stuff like that. So he suggested that I do it for 90 days, and then I finally got those numbers back, and all my numbers came in line. Now, this was still on the statin. All my numbers came
right
in line, total, you know, 180, 181. HDL was 50, come up to 59, and LDL had dropped to 109. And the trigs came down from
excellent
167 to 67.
Wow.
Then 30 days off the medication, I just did that, and my total went up to 269. HDL fell to 46, and my LDL went up to 210. And the trigs fell to 58 from 67. Now
here's the question.
Go ahead.
And you know what? We're probably going to want to get you back on Destination Health. I'm going to run out of time here. And this is
mm-hmm.
a really, really good example. So any chance we could get you on Destination Health tomorrow?
Sure. What time will you do that?
What we'll do tomorrow, we do our normal 2 hours of recording, and then we do go right into an hour of Destination Health.
Okay. Okay. Is there any chance I'm sorry.
Let me do this. We could get you on earlier if we need to during the regular show. If we could hold you till Destination Health, that would be great. We can make sure we get you on. I'm going to put you on hold. I'll have Lisa pick up, and we'll figure out the details, because this is a really good example that I want to talk about. I think there's a lot that we could learn in here. And I don't want to rush it right now because I am all out of time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, we are going to head into a second hour of the program here, so here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, building a fleet. The list goes on and on. We'll talk about anything you want to talk about here on the show. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. I'm going to get to those calls in just a little bit. You know, one of the big changes around here on the show in the last year has been the addition of the topic of health. And I have done a tremendous amount of research. I've always liked to do research, whether it was fuel mileage or tires or maintenance or taxes or financial planning, retirement accounts, all that stuff. It's what I do. As much as I like to do research, I have even been surprised by how much I've really loved digging into the medical research. At last count, I was on my book number 86. I've read 86 books on health, fitness, nutrition, diseases, diets, exercise, you know, medical screening, cholesterol, you name it. 86 books so far, and I've also read, or I shouldn't say read, but I have browsed through another 40,000 pages of medical research to verify what is being said in the books. Now, it's 40,000 pages, but when you go look at medical research, I can't imagine anybody reads that stuff word for word. Normally, it's a lot of charts and graphs, and when I say that I've read those 40,000 pages, what I've really done is if I read something about cholesterol, let's say, and it references a certain research paper, then I'll go find that research paper, download it, and I'll at least read the summaries, the introductions, the important numbers, and I'll make sure that what the author is saying in the book is really what's in the report. So between, you know, 86 books and 40,000 pages of medical research, we put a lot of time and effort into this, and it's one of those things, I have no idea how we're ever going to make any money on this. And, you know, no matter what anybody else thinks, you've got to make money for the time you put into things at some point. I'm doing it mostly because I really enjoy it right now. I'm learning a lot that's keeping me healthier. And we're really helping a lot of people in the industry. But at some point, I'm putting in 30 hours a week just on this kind of research. I've gone back to school to become a nutritional therapist, so about 20 hours a week is that. So one of the things I was interested in seeing, every year there is a survey done about the top 10 industry concerns. And, you know, it's usually pretty close to the same stuff. ELDs, hours of service, parking, driver recruiting, driver turnover, the economy, roads and infrastructure. It's usually, it's always the same. They move around. One of the new ones on the list, though, and it actually moved up quite a bit this year, is number 7 on that list of 10 is driver health and wellness. It really is an issue that the industry needs to address. And we just feel like we're in a very good place to address it, mostly because of the trust we already have with our listeners. And it really is my strength, being able to spend a lot of time researching a complicated topic and then making it a little easier to understand for most people. So we will always continue to do business and accounting and maintenance and fuel mileage and all those things. We're not giving up on any of those. We're just adding a new one so we can bring even more value to our listeners. And obviously it is on the minds of most of the people in the industry. Let's get started on some phone calls today. Let's go to Oklahoma. Paul, welcome to the program.
Howdy, you just caught me. I'm nearly in Texas.
All right. What's on your mind today?
On a previous show, and you had somebody talking about the merge point when you're in a construction zone. In Oklahoma this morning, Oklahoma, they normally between 1/4 mile and 0.4 mile, they have the sign out, state law, merge now. So I always run all the way right to that sign, and I put my turn signal on, and I get over. Well, I saw two people get tickets this morning because they passed state troopers that were in the lineup. Two cars, and they pulled over. Yeah. So, but they overshot the sign. Thought, oh, I'll just sneak in at the end. But I think the best way is to make the merge point closer to where the lane runs out, not further away from it. Because if you take a funnel, say it's 10 inches around at the top, and it has a 20-inch tube on it where it comes out that's 2 inches wide, it's real slow coming out. But if you cut the tube where it's only 2 inches long, the same amount of product comes out quicker.
But wait a minute. I don't think that analogy works, because the tube itself would really be the construction zone, which we really can't control the length of. The,
yep.
funnel part, the bigger we make, the longer we make the funnel part, the more opportunity there is to zipper in smoothly and uniformly.
Yeah, I don't know. But there's a couple of states out there that, like Pennsylvania, they do the same too. They have maintained two lanes to merge point, so, and they always put their merge point closer to where the lane runs out. So either way, you're going to wait in time, but it's just the amount of time you're going to wait. So
yeah, and that's really when I answered the question the other day. My first statement was, this is still a very controversial topic. We don't even have states that agree with it. We have states that have very different views on this and very different laws. So I don't know. And I think this is another one of those issues where you're going to have a very tough time convincing anybody to change their mind.
Yeah. So, but I've got my theory, and I do it all the time. If the lane's open, I stay in that lane right till it says merge now, or it runs out. So I don't know if it works out quicker for everybody, but it works out quicker for me.
Yeah, well, my philosophy has always been that as soon as I know which lane is closing, I get in the other one. I mean, as soon as I know. I wish they would give me more warning, you know, further back when traffic is still spread out more, especially in a long vehicle. You know, who wants to have to fight over and, you know, if you can tell me soon enough, what I really hate is when the traffic is backed up so far in two lanes and I still haven't seen a sign. So now I don't know which lane.
Is it a wreck or is it construction or you don't know what's happening? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so the sooner you can tell me which lane to be in, the sooner I'll just get in that lane and be done with it.
But you have to be blessed to know at least they are working on the roads because they need fixing. So maybe we should look at it from that point of view.
Yeah, the eternal optimist. And then I would say maybe they should fix the roads better the first time so they don't have to keep doing it all the time. That's a whole nother story. Let's go to Ohio. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Kevin, bought a truck in 08, backup plan, and then bought another truck. Had two trucks, worked 14 guys over 6 years in two trucks, and got this truck that I'm currently in. That's the only truck I have. Really good shape, did all majors, engine, transmission, and rears. My question is, should I have, say, $20,000 in reserves so if this one got in a bad wreck or, you know, I put a, you know, rod through the block, or should I have a $12,000 truck just sitting in reserve? Which do you think is a better plan?
I think if I had that choice, I would rather have the cash. And when we come back, I'll explain why. It doesn't mean that having a truck sitting there as a backup isn't a bad thing, because it's a pretty quick fix if we have a major problem. But let me tell you why I think I'd rather have the cash. Stick around. We'll be right back with that and more stuff right after this break. I'm Kevin Rothford. Yeah. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Before the break, I was talking with Ken in Ohio. Ken, you know, it's interesting because the other day I was talking about sometimes I get a question and then I'll get a question a week later that sounds the same, but I'll answer it totally differently. And I know that confuses people. This is one of those. Had you called me and said, I already have that backup truck for whatever reason, should I just keep it there as a backup or should I sell it, have the cash instead? I would have told you just keep the truck. But this is a case where you have the cash and I wouldn't go buy a truck because I'd rather have the cash because it gives me a lot more flexibility. You know, if something happens to your truck, you're going to have many options if you, maybe it does pay to fix the truck. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it pays to go buy a second truck. But you would have the ability to do both. Or something totally different that we can't even think about right now. Cash gives us lots of flexibility. But then there's another reason. When we buy a truck, we always buy at retail. When we sell a truck, we always sell at wholesale. Every time we create that transaction of buying and selling, we lose money. We lose money that we get no real value for. So to go out and buy this truck retail, if you never used it, not only is it going to cost you money while it's sitting there and insurance and a little bit of upkeep and batteries and some other things, if you never use it and you end up getting rid of it someday, you're going to take that hit again. Whereas if you keep cash, not only does it not cost you any money to keep cash around, you might make a little bit in today's world with interest rates. I'm not getting too excited about what you're going to make, but the money's always going to be there and it's not going to cost you anything. You're not going to lose any money in the transaction. Does that all make sense?
Yes, sir. I think flexibility is the way to go. I was just kind of thinking, you know, maybe the trucks, the pre-EGRs are going to dry up and the cores for Series 60s are going to go from $5,000 to $10,000, you know, or, you know, it's a finite number out there. But I think flexibility,
yeah,
I already have an engine that could go in a glider or whatever, you know, or fix it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think having the cash, I don't worry too much about these the availability of the older trucks or the older engines drying up. In fact, you know, Bruce Mallinson from Pittsburgh Power is going to be out here in a couple weeks. And one of the things we're going to talk about is kind of ramping up some gliders and maybe building some N14 gliders or I've always said that gliders are going to be around for a long time. Most of the people who understood gliders said we probably still have another decade. And then out of the blue, the government starts talking about gliders meeting EPA requirements. Well, then gliders would just go away completely. Now, part of the reason why I was saying they're going to be here forever, because the government had never addressed it. And people said, oh, they're... You don't know that they're going to do something, not until they at least talk about it. And there was no talk. Now, there's talk. The government has could eliminate the whole glider industry. That changes the game, which means I will now change my plan. That's why I'm going to get together with Bruce, and we are going to talk about making more gliders with more options available while you can still get them. If I were in the business of moving freight with trucks the way I used to be, I would replace every truck in my fleet right now with a glider. Because once they're in, they'll be in. They'll be grandfathered. And I, like I say, if I still had my three trucks at FedEx, once I read that bill, I would have replaced all three with gliders just to make sure I could. So we are going to work on some ideas around that that thought. Let's get back to some phone calls. Let's go to Arizona. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I've got a question. I'm going to incorporate this year. I'm thinking about putting on a second truck. I live in Michigan. The company that I'm leased to is in Nebraska. and right now the business license that I have is from Nebraska. How does that work for me to incorporate, and who should I talk to about doing the paperwork and stuff?
There's a couple ways to look at this. The different states really don't matter. All of that can be worked around. You do want to file your corporation in Michigan, though. You know, we hear all the goofy late-night commercials about, you know, file in Las Vegas and there's all these benefits. It's all garbage because the only way you would ever want to file in Las Vegas or in Nevada is if you lived in Nevada. Because if you live in Michigan and that's where the business is, you can file in Nevada, but you're also going to have to file in Michigan as a foreign corporation operating out of Michigan. Not only does it wipe out all the benefits of having your corporation in Nevada, it creates a whole new set of problems, paperwork, costs, all kinds of things. So those commercials just drive me crazy. You want to form your corporation in the state you live and run the business in, and whatever their rules are, you just deal with them.
Okay.
As far as who you should talk to, you know, you can go dirt cheap on this and use the online legal services like LegalZoom. There's tons of websites where you can go file your own corporation, and you still pay all the fees. What you save is the cost of paying somebody else to do the work. I'm not a big fan of those. I've done a couple of them myself. It can be just fine. But in the long run, I'm assuming one of the reasons you're forming a corporation is because you're profitable enough that you're going to save tax.
My deposits are over $70,000 this year at this point.
So I would rather spend $300 to $500 extra to have somebody set this up for me and make sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted and we get this all right. You know, $300 or $500 bucks in the big scheme of things isn't that
right.
much money. Some people will say, well, if I can save it, then I'm going to save it. Yeah, I get that. When I can save a little money on fuel, I want to save money on fuel. This is a one-time shot. The little bit you save could be wiped out because one thing went wrong that we'll never see coming. I'm a fan. Pay the attorney, pay the firm that knows what they're doing. Get it done right. You'll be able to sleep better at night. You could certainly give us a call. We aren't totally done with all of our programs yet, but we are certainly, with our accounting firm, we are going to be handling payroll for corporations and setup and all that stuff.
Okay. Now, here's the other thing. I do all my own accounting. I spent 13 years at H&R Block, and I do all my own stuff.
Oh, good.
The incorporation I'm not going to do myself on. So just basically like a local lawyer or something like that. That sets up corporations. Okay. Now, as far as the, like, for the payroll, because I've been, you know, I'm just sole proprietor, so I've never done the self-employment or the 940s, 941s, and all that stuff. Is there a program out there? Does your program figure that all, you know, what the withholding would be, and, you know, I can generate my QuickBooks online to that?
QuickBooks Online is hands down my favorite for doing payroll. Now, again, we are putting together a payroll service for our clients only so that they don't have to go out and have two different programs. So it won't be part of our software, but it will be part of the services we offer through our accounting firm will be that we'll handle the payroll and the filing and all that stuff for you. But if you don't mind using QuickBooks as your primary accounting, QuickBooks Online, hands down, is the way to go. It's inexpensive. It's easy. You set it up one time, and payroll becomes a click of a button once a month, and you're done.
Okay. And that will generate the forms that I need to send into the IRS with the checks and stuff like that.
Depending on how much you want to pay for the service, the beauty of QuickBooks is it has different levels. And the level that I've always used, and I think it's worth every penny, is there are no forms, there are no checks. This is all tied to your bank account. And when you say, okay, payroll this week or this month is, you know, $7,000 for me as the driver, that's it. You transfer the money into your personal account as payroll. QuickBooks does everything. They file everything electronically. They pull the money out of your account, transfer it to the IRS. There are no forms. There is no paperwork. It's really, like I say, for me, it's worth every penny to do my payroll that
okay.
way.
Okay, all right. That makes a lot of sense then, because that will take a couple of minutes to put off my way.
Yep.
Okay.
It takes away that worry of, oh my God, I forgot I had a deadline. I've got to find the forms. I've got to get to a post office. I've got to write a check. I've got to get to the bank. Yeah, especially being on the road. It's not that expensive if you're doing payroll for one person once a month. And it's really, really nice. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get right back to the phones. We're going to head off to Nebraska this time. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin.
Hey there.
Hey,
what can I help you with today?
Well, first off, I want to send kudos out to Chad. Stopped in there week before last and got my truck aligned. Night and day difference in the handling of my truck.
Oh, good. Good. I'd love to hear that. And that is
a difference it made.
That is a clear indication. In fact, people will ask me a lot of times, I got new tires, should I go get my truck aligned? Not if there was nothing wrong with it before. The only time I ever let anybody touch my alignment is when I have irregular tire wear that would indicate I have an alignment problem, or I have a handling problem that would allow, you know, would indicate that I've got an alignment problem. Otherwise, if it's right, don't screw with it. When you go in and you can see that much difference, that's a really good sign that something was wrong and the alignment fixed it.
Yeah, well, I just recently got my truck on the road. And I had to herd it more than drive it. And
yeah,
so
okay.
I knew it was an alignment problem, and I went in to Chad. He inspected my suspension and told me this, that, and the other was wrong with it. Go get it fixed. He got me set up with, I believe it's T&E, over across the river to get that repair
yep.
work done. I went back, and the alignment, he checked it five times before he said, okay, it's good to my standards. And it's night and day difference.
I'd love that. Thank you for the feedback. You bring up a good point. And T&E, by the way, is the company that we've partnered with for years during the CMC. We sent everybody over there for all the work during the CMC, and they've just been amazing. Chris over there that runs that shop is just a great guy, and we love that shop. You mentioned something, though, that is one of the reasons why Chad is so good and why the whole MD alignment system is good as long as the technicians get it. Most alignment shops you pull into, they throw the truck up on the rack. The computer measures everything, tells them what to change or what to fix, and then as long as they change that and fix it, they're done. And they just send you on your way. Well, we don't know that the computer's right, that it's been calibrated right, that the suspension was sitting properly that time when we made those adjustments. The MD alignment system, and Chad is one of their best, it's it doesn't rely on a computer. It relies on an individual that knows what the hell he's doing and how to measure things, but he doesn't even trust his own measurements because he knows that there are other factors that could throw that measurement off. So what he does is he measures it, gets it where he thinks it should be, and he takes the truck out and drives it, or tells you to take it out and drive it, and ask, is it pulling? Is it wandering? Is it doing this? And if it is, then we'll tweak it again. And that's the right way to do an alignment, and that's why we get so many satisfied customers that go to Chad.
Yeah. Well, he's anal about getting it right. And
yes.
I love mechanics that are that way. If
yep.
I can find a mechanic that's anal about getting it right, I'll go back to him every time I need work done.
Absolutely. Good stuff.
And I have
all right, so
two samples there that I'd like you to look at.
All right, so I am looking at the engine oil sample right now. This is a Series 60. What year?
It's an 01.
Okay. Have you looked at the sample itself?
Yes, I have. I don't have it right in front of me now, but
okay.
I have looked at it.
That's all right. So what I want to explain to you is everything up on the top line, you have those four yellow boxes up on the top line, which is a level two. Ignore those. Act like they don't even exist. We don't even really need to talk about them other than I'll just say those are just additives, and the additives levels aren't that critical. They change. I mean, I can pull 2 gallons of oil off the shelf, same oil, same everything, and we'll get different additive levels in them. If you buy a gallon of Rotella on the East Coast and a gallon on the West Coast, you can get wildly different additive levels, but it's just not important. It just doesn't matter. In 20 years of reading oil samples, the additives have never meant anything. For me, they could just take that off, and it wouldn't bother me a bit. So we can just ignore that. Let's talk about what's really good first. The wear metals, very, very good. Those are good numbers, nothing at all to be concerned about there. We have no dirt, which would show up as silicon. We have no coolant, which would show up as sodium and potassium. So then we look at the physical properties of the oil and contaminants. You've got some fuel dilution here. Has this truck been sitting around? You mentioned you just got it on the road. Has it been sitting around?
Yeah. I know it sat for at least a year, because from the time I first test drove it until I got it on the road was a year.
Okay.
And so, and before that, I'm not sure how long it sat, but I think it's probably sat for a good long time before that. I have been going through a gallon of oil about every 3,500 to 4,000 miles, and when that sample was taken, it was a gallon low, and the reason I didn't go ahead and top it up before I took that sample is because I wanted to put some oil treatment in to see if I could slow down my oil consumption.
Got it. Okay. So let's do this. I'm not going to put too much faith into this sample. I want to see one more. And what I'd like you to do is make sure that you do take the next sample when it's topped off. So, you know, when you're getting close to a sample and you're a gallon low, put in a gallon in the morning, run the truck all day. At the end of the day, leave it running, take your sample, and then let's take a look, because there is some fuel dilution here that could have been because the truck was sitting around a lot. The base has dropped. That could be because we do have a lot of blow-by. If you're using that much oil, we're getting a lot of blow-by. But I would rather see one more sample with it topped off before we really make any decisions. There's nothing on here that scares me. There's nothing on here that's going to cause any major problems. So it would be a little better to wait.
Yeah, I took this one with about 12,000 miles on the oil because I wanted to get a baseline.
Yeah,
and
that's a good idea.
I'm figuring the next one will be at about 30, 4,000 miles on the oil.
Good. Okay. And let's wait for that one before we make any decisions. Like I say, there's nothing here cause you any immediate problems. It's actually a pretty good-looking sample. So let's see what happens with that fuel dilution before we make any decisions. So now I'm looking at the reefer.
Yeah.
And this one looks really good. I mean, I don't see anything on here that would concern me at all. Again, all those yellows are up in the additives, so we can just ignore those. Fuel dilution at 2.9 is nothing to worry about at all. Wear metals are really, really low. Viscosity is perfect. Base number is holding up. This is a really good-looking sample.
All right. Well, I appreciate your input on them.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. I'm looking at the clock, and it looks like that's going to take us into a break or close enough. I don't want to have to rush a phone call, so I'll take us into the break. And when we come back, we will get to more of your calls and questions. So don't go away. Couple things. It's that time of year. What time of year? It's the fourth quarter. There's a lot going on in the fourth quarter in trucking. Mostly your accounting. Accounting taken care of now. Don't wait one more day. By the time we get to the fourth quarter, if you don't have a profit and loss statement for every month, you are screwing up. You are wasting money. You're losing money. You're going to pay more in taxes. Don't do it one more day. Whether you decide to do your own accounting, whether you have a good accountant you know that understands trucks, or whether you do what I think you should do, which is use our software and our service, but I'm a little biased. No matter what you do, get it taken care of. Don't put it off one more day. I didn't think we were going to get to the break that fast. But the other thing, be really, really thinking about your equipment and yourself and your truck and getting them ready for winter. I put a good checklist up on our website at letstruck.com. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to see how many calls we can get to here. We're off to Ohio. Abdul, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Kevin.
Kevin, can I help you with today?
Yes, sir. I have a question about, loads and rates-wise. Like, this year, it has dropped dramatically compared to 2014. And I was wondering, what do you think your predictions are for, like, next year?
Wow. Thanks for the vote of confidence. You must think I'm way smarter than I really am. One of the things I don't seem to be all that great at, considering all the reading I do and how much I pay attention to this stuff, I usually don't make predictions because when I do, I'm usually wrong. But honestly, even the people who do this for a living are usually wrong. So even when I read what they're saying, I could find 10 economists and we'll come up with 13 different answers somehow. I don't know. I really don't. There's so much conflicting information. I've said many times that, 10 years ago, we could at least recognize patterns in business. I don't see patterns anymore. It seems like since 2008, whether it's, you know, just that the economy is changing so much because we're moving into a more digital economy. I'd like to blame it on Obama, but, you know, I don't know if that makes any sense or not. But since he's been president, there aren't any patterns. I mean, I can't see. We think we're coming out of a recession. All the indicators look good. Then 2 months later, they don't look good. Then some look good and some look bad. It's really, really confusing anymore. So I don't even know. I mean, if I were to answer you right now, I would probably flip a coin and just go by that, because it'd be as good as any information I have. What I can tell you, and I know why, you know, we're all curious. We'd all like to know. We'd all think if we thought it was right, we would make other decisions. But what I've finally determined in business is it's interesting to look at that, to ask those questions, to try to figure it out. But what's much more important is, what are you going to do in 2016?
Right.
Because the things you do every day will have a much, much bigger impact on your results than anything that happens in the economy. If you do most things right, if you have goals and you're working towards them and you're learning and you're paying attention and you're tweaking, if you're doing most things right and the economy tanks, you're still going to succeed. On the other hand, if you're just hoping for another 2014 to happen next year and you're doing everything wrong, you could fail spectacularly while the economy is booming.
Yep. That's all I had. So, thank you for answering.
You're welcome. And like I say, I read this stuff all the time. But the more I read people who should know a whole lot more about this than I do, the more I find out that they're never very right about this either. Sometimes they get lucky. I have a 50-50 chance if I say, oh, rates are going to boom next year, or if I say rates are going to tank next year. I could throw in one other option and say they're going to be about the same. I've got pretty good odds, 33%, I guess, that I'll get it right, but it would just be a guess. I could give you all kinds of facts why I think it's going to happen. Even if I got it right, it wouldn't mean any of my facts had anything to do with it. So I read that kind of stuff. I look at the predictions and that. I really don't make them anymore because I hate being wrong. So what I do is focus on what I can do to make everything better, no matter what happens to the economy. Let's go to Minnesota. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. This is Paul Anderson. Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Oh, I heard you on a previous show, you were talking about the different ways of measuring ketones.
Yes.
And, and I'm the one with a Master of Science in Nursing degree, willing to help out drivers who have questions on the ketone diet and stuff. I'm just going to go over what the different things are that are measured in your liver. When the blood sugar and your insulin levels reach a certain balance, your body starts saying, well, let's make some ketones to start feeding the cells. It's the fatty acids are broken down. The first step is acetylacetate, which is actually the only true ketone. And from there in the liver, it's converted to beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetone. And as you know, if you've probably bought cleaners and stuff, you know acetone is a highly volatile substance, a lot like alcohol. So that's the one that's measured with the breathalyzer test.
Correct. And that's also the one, if you don't mind, jump in there real quick. That's also the one every now and then you'll hear people say, oh, people on a ketogenic diet have bad breath. And what they're smelling is that byproduct, that acetone.
Right. The other two products, the acetylacetate, is the one that's measured in the urine. And the reason why that'll vary so much is it all depends on when the last time you went to the bathroom was, how much water you drank, things like that.
That makes sense.
Dilute it, and it's just the average. The beta-hydroxybutyrate is the one that's measured with the blood sample, and it also makes up 80% of the three compounds in your blood. So it's the one that medicine uses, you know, and it's the most accurate. It gives you the exact reading right now.
Yeah.
The big thing is, for people just following on their diet, which one do you want to use? My thing is use whatever you're comfortable using. It really doesn't matter what your exact reading is today. You're kind of always looking for an average. So use the least expensive, the one you're most comfortable with. That's my take on it.
You know, I think that's a really good point, and I've been using a lot of them, and the one I always come back to is the breath meter. You know, it's got that initial cost. I think I paid like $170 for it. But once I make that initial cost, some days I use that thing 20 times a day. Now, I'm a little crazy because I try different things and I want to see the results and track things and learn something. But the beauty of this, I can use it over and over and over as many times as I want. There's no supplies, doesn't cost me anything once I have it. You know, the software tracks everything, keeps a record for me. So I like that. There's no question, though, that, like you said, the blood is far more accurate. The strips are just crazy expensive. So, you know, if I want to try an experiment like, you know, get up in the morning, see what it is, wait 4 hours before I eat, see what happens, go work out while I'm fasting, you know, that might be four tests in a day at $3 a test. You know, plus I got to keep poking myself all day long. So it is more accurate, but it's also more expensive and, you know, more of a pain. Honestly, after doing all of this testing, what I would tell most people is you can kind of tell when you're ketogenic. I mean, when you're doing a diet like this and you feel good and your appetite becomes normal and, you know, you've got energy, there's a pretty good chance you're probably producing at least a minimal amount of ketones, and it's probably more important to do this so where you feel good. Like I found, you know, if I get up at the high level of ketosis, I don't feel as good as I do when I'm in the lower and mid levels. So I kind of doubt that it's any healthier to be up there. You know, I do lose more weight, but losing weight isn't my goal now. I mean, when I stayed up at the high end of ketosis, I actually got to a lower weight than I felt comfortable with. And when I stay in the lower and mid levels, I actually gain about 10 or 12 pounds over that bottom, but I feel better. And that, to me, seems like a more important measure.
Right. And when you read, like, Dr. Addy's stuff, he tells how he's more carbohydrate sensitive than his wife, you know, and he compares their two diets. You know, and everybody's different. You have to find where you're comfortable, how much carbohydrates put you in that good feeling, you know, and that's where just kind of a basic line of your ketone levels will just kind of help you get there and balance that a little bit.
Yeah, and that's a good point because that's kind of what I found. And that is a really good thing for people to remember. Everybody is different. There is no one-size diet fits all. It depends on some genetics, some activity level. Some of it depends on how much damage you've done to your body in your lifetime already. I mean, if you are very insulin resistant, then you're going to have to get much lower on carbohydrate intake for a while than somebody who has never been insulin resistant. You know, that's thanks for that, by the way. That was a very good explanation of how those three different tests work and what we're looking for. We need to get you back on Destination Health because it's a great topic, and we'll talk about it more. But the music's playing. That means I'm all out of time. So many questions, so little time. We'll tackle it again next show. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining me. We will do it again tomorrow. Boy, I see a lot of questions we didn't get to today. So call in early tomorrow, press one quicker, and I promise we'll get to your calls. Tomorrow we're scheduled for 2 hours of Trucking Business and Beyond, and then we'll go right into an hour of Destination Health. So we'll see you then.